Voice of America.
The United Nations calls it the largest displacement crisis since World War II. Worldwide, more than 100 million people fleeing violence and conflict at home and seeking refuge elsewhere. But how welcoming is the rest of the world? And are countries growing less accepting of migrants and refugees? Also,
we believe that we are fully compliant with our domestic and international obligations, and preparations for our future flights and the next flights have already begun.
The UK vows to press ahead with its controversial plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, despite a dramatic legal showdown. Kigali says it's ready to take in refugees from all over the world. We'll take a closer look at the multi-million dollar UK-Rwanda migrant deal, which critics have called catastrophic, inhumane, and immoral.
We don't think it's immoral to offer a home to people. We will give them an opportunity to see what it's like to live in this country. We do not consider living in Rwanda a punishment.
And my conversation with the head of the International Monetary Fund's Abebe Selassie. Hear what he told me about the knock-on effects of the global economic crisis and the state of the relationship between African countries and the IMF. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Heidi Adams. It's probably one of the hardest decisions any human being has to face, to escape danger and hunger at home and seek refuge elsewhere, to start over in a different place among strangers who might not necessarily want or welcome you. For many migrants and refugees, fleeing home is a matter of life and death. Well, this week, the international community marked World Refugee Day in the shadows of what the UN says is the largest displacement crisis since World War II. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine in February, the UN Refugee Agency says there were already 89 million forcibly displaced persons worldwide. With the Ukrainian exodus, the number now tops 100 million.
Remember, we are now all focused on Ukraine very much, but Ukraine comes after a line of other emergencies.
The agency's new Global Trends report says that five crises last year accounted for nearly 70% of all displaced people. They are from Syria, Venezuela, Afghanistan, South Sudan, and Myanmar. In Afghanistan, 24 million people need humanitarian aid. The economy is in tatters, and the Taliban is imposing more restrictions on women and girls. UNHCR says all these pressures have pushed 2.7 million Afghans to leave.
So people are crossing the borders, sometimes with visas, but most of the time without visas and without documentation, sometimes up to 20,000 people a day.
Many people flee to neighboring countries. More than 1 million have left Ukraine for safety in Poland.
People, refugees, they flee not as far as possible from the conflict, but as close as possible. And they return not as late as possible, but as early as possible.
Only 5.7 million internally displaced persons and refugees returned home or to their place of origin in 2021. The focus for this year's World Refugee Day on June 20th is the right to seek safety. Richer nations have mixed records on welcoming refugees and asylum seekers. The High Commissioner for Refugees says he hopes those nations now understand the relationship between bombs and flight.
People flee because they're afraid. It's not just the Ukrainians. The Syrians have fled bombs. People in Tigray have fled bombs. People in the Sahel flee either bombs or vicious attacks. So fear of insecurity is the same whether you are a Ukrainian or in Nicaragua.
Shaken by fear and uncertainty, Irina Morikovas fled Ukraine with her son soon after Russia invaded, leaving her husband behind.
We took just the most important things and cross the border.
Now in the Netherlands, Marijke Vos, an artist, has collaborated with UNHCR on this year's World Refugee Day Twitter emoji.
When we open a door of our house to people who need it, for refugees, for example, who need help, we like open our heart, because house is heart of the family.
For tens of millions of refugees and displaced people worldwide, they also hope to find a safe and warm welcome. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Now, with more than 100 million people displaced, how welcoming is the world? In a 2020 study by Gallup, it showed the world is becoming less tolerant of migrants, with European nations among the least accepting. And that study was conducted before Brexit, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the current conflicts in places like Ukraine and Ethiopia. The United States, for example, has been accepting fewer refugees in recent years. It's now on track to resettle just under 19,000 in the 2022 financial year. And that's a fragment of the 125,000 refugee ceiling set by U.S. President Joe Biden. This means more refugees in the world with fewer options. Well, I discussed this with Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Egeland is currently in Baidoa, Somalia, where hundreds of thousands of people have left home in search of water, food, and safety. Well, Egeland says he's seeing firsthand how climate change and conflict are driving people to a life of displacement and despair. I asked him if he thinks the world is becoming less accepting of migrants and refugees.
Well, the reason that the world reached this unprecedented milestone of more than 100 million displaced by violence and conflict is the war in Ukraine. 14 million new people displaced by another senseless war. On top of the Syria war, the last decade, that's 12, 13 million. We have Yemen, we have Congo. But we also have Somalia, where I am now, where millions have been displaced by both violence and conflict, and now also increasingly and dramatically by drought. We're seeing a wave of horrific nationalism, xenophobic trends that are terrible. I mean, a Somali from here, I'm now in Baidoa in central Somalia, a family from Baidoa have no chance, really, of reaching anywhere outside of Somalia, so they have to be internally displaced. Two-thirds of the 105 million displaced worldwide now are displaced within their own countries. And those who are becoming refugees are predominantly becoming refugees in neighboring poor countries. North America, the United States, Europe are taking very few refugees. We're not there to protect women, children, families fleeing. Europe is welcoming Ukrainians, but not people fleeing from other places. The U.S. is not even accepting many from their own neighborhood, those who are fleeing violence in Central America.
Well, Egeland says it is possible to end the global refugee crisis, but at the same time, he's seeing some worrying trends.
I'm both hopeful and concerned at the moment. The number one problem is conflict resolution is not working. Wars are not ending. So we're accumulating new people displaced by violence at the same time as there is no way for them out of displacement. It's very hard for people to return home to the war-ravaged country because conflicts last forever. And Ukraine war may also be a very long-lasting war now. Here in Somalia, it's been war now for 50 years, continuously. And it's not resolved just outside of Baidoa, where I am. Al-Shabaab is present now as they've been for a generation. The other big problem is we're not helping people out of displacement by relocation to other safe places, nor in help in integration where they are. So the displaced end up in displacement camps for too long. All of this is exacerbated dramatically by climate change. At the moment, I'm really shocked by seeing how bad the drought now is in Somalia and how little the world seems to care, with something which is a catastrophe fueled by everybody but the Somalis themselves. They did not cause climate change, but they are first and hardest hit. It is man-made, it's human-made from A to Z, both the climate crisis, but also these wars. Men with power, men with guns, can end this the endless violence. Ukraine conflict can end tomorrow if there is some sense in the Kremlin and if there is a willingness to negotiate on both sides the issues that needs to be dealt with in terms of minority protection, etc. So can the issues here in Africa be dealt with? There are too many armed groups, yes, but there can't be conflict resolution on the local level, on the regional level, on the national level, on the continental level as well.
And that was Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to me earlier from Baidoa, Somalia. It's been called inhumane, immoral and catastrophic. A controversial plan by the British government to send some migrants and asylum seekers to Rwanda. It's part of a multi-million dollar deal between London and Kigali. And the first flight carrying hundreds of asylum seekers was cancelled earlier this month after legal challenges by rights groups and campaigners. But British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he will press on with his policy, even as leaders of Britain's former colonies gather in Rwanda this week for the Commonwealth Heads of State Summit. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports.
Asylum seeker Hadi, not his real name, fled persecution in his home country of Iraq because he is gay. He shows the scars of a recent attempted rape. He reached Britain in January after crossing the English Channel on a small dinghy. Now he is terrified of being sent to Rwanda.
We suffered and escaped death. We crossed the sea, all to be sent to Rwanda? Kill me or sentence me to death instead of sending me to Rwanda. I don't have anything to do with Rwanda. As a gay person and a supporter of refugees, this is an unjust and criminal decision.
Hadi is among the more than 10,000 migrants this year alone who have crossed the English Channel in small boats to reach Britain. Dozens have died attempting the crossing. Britain says the flow has to stop. Earlier this year, British Home Secretary Priti Patel signed a deal to fly asylum seekers 6,000 kilometres away to Rwanda for processing there as a deterrent to migrants hoping to cross the channel.
We're a government, along with our partners, the government of Rwanda, finding new innovative solutions to global problems where I'm afraid other organisations and other countries, you know, are not coming up with alternatives, and the status quo is simply not acceptable anymore.
The migrants will be housed in hostels like this one in Kigali.
At some point, once their status has been fixed, they will have to go and live with other Rwandans, but they will be free. They will not be prisoners.
The first flight was due to depart last week, but was blocked minutes before takeoff by the European Court of Human Rights. Critics say it breaches refugee law, but the government says the policy is legal and will deter migrants.
When people come here illegally and when they break the law, it's important that we make that distinction. That's what we're doing with our Rwanda policy.
But the policy has been widely criticised, including by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
People come from Sudan, Syria, Iraq, Iran. They are all terrified. They have all fled their home countries due to absolutely terrible circumstances. a number of them have suffered extreme torture or trafficking.
The Commonwealth meeting will be overshadowed by the dispute over Britain's asylum policy, says analyst Murphy.
And in a way, it's focused international attention on Rwanda's human rights record. Since the 1990s, the Commonwealth has tried to reinvent itself as an organisation that's united more by common values than by common history. The problem is it hasn't been very good at policing those values.
Rwanda denies the government commits human rights abuses, and supporters of President Kagame say hosting the Commonwealth meeting is another milestone in the country's development. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Well, now for a closer look at this multi-million-dollar migrant deal between Britain and Rwanda, I'm joined in studio by Eddie Remmer. He's a senior editor with VOA's Central African News Service and VOA's UK-based correspondent Henry Ridgewell. He, of course, covers the United Kingdom and parts of Europe for us, and he joins us via Skype from London. Henry and Eddie, welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
Eddie, I'm going to start with you. Please give us just sort of the lay of the land here. How did this deal come about? Why Rwanda? And what exactly is in it for Kigali?
I think the discussions about this deal started probably around last year. And then they started hammering it up around the early part of this year. We understand that UK had considered other countries like Albania and Ghana, but at the end of the day, they were not able to meet or probably even accept to take in the immigrants. So Rwanda was willing to do it. For them, they say that this is part of being a solution to the global migration problem. The UK says that this is part of trying to solve the problem of immigration. So basically the deal is all about UK sending some of the immigrants who it considers illegal, who cross into UK through either boats or lorries. And most of them, when they are considered inadmissible, that's when they will be sent to Rwanda. So when they get to Rwanda, the responsibility will be on Rwanda, number one, to take care of the refugees, either process asylum for them to be refugees in Rwanda. The other thing is providing those refugees with an option of going back to their home countries. And the other thing is seeing if there's any third country that can probably take those refugees. So that's how we stand as of now.
Well, speaking of third countries, Henry, what do you know about this deal? What more do you know about this deal on your end? And if this works out for Boris Johnson's administration, are we likely to see this policy expanded and more deals like this struck with other willing countries in Africa and other parts of the world?
On your first question, there are a lot of uncertainties over this policy, not least whether it will even happen, because, as you know, there are several legal challenges. The first flight was due to take off last week, but was blocked at the 11th hour by a successful challenge in the European Court of Human Rights. There is also a legal challenge in Britain's High Court to the entire government policy, which is due to be heard next month. And if that is ruled illegal, then the British government will have to go back to the drawing board on its migration policy. The details of the policy itself are yet to be fully worked out. The government hasn't given exact numbers of how many people it intends to send to Rwanda, although there have been suggestions of that Rwanda could process up to around 500 people every year. But given in 2021 that 29,000 migrants arrived in these sort of dangerous routes on Britain's shores, that would mean that only 1-2% of those refugees and migrants, asylum seekers arriving, may be sent to Rwanda. And therefore, there are questions over the deterrent effect of the policy itself. We also don't know exactly what will happen to the asylum seekers when they reach Rwanda. Will they, those who are granted asylum in Rwanda, will they stay there or will they simply leave and try to restart their journeys back to Europe? If they aren't granted asylum in Rwanda, what happens to them then? Are they then repatriated to their countries of origin? So many question marks hanging over the policy itself. On your question of whether this will be expanded. I think it's taken a long time for this policy to be agreed between Britain and Rwanda, and that points to the difficulties that may lie ahead with any expansion. Britain and Rwanda do have a strong relationship. President Paul Kagame is close to several members of the British Conservative Party who have supported him, his government, and the development of Rwanda over recent years. And I think that is the reason why Rwanda is able to host the Commonwealth Summit at the moment with Britain's support, and that is the reason why Britain has managed to agree this migrant deal with Rwanda. Whether any other country would agree to such a policy, I think at the moment is unlikely given the political difficulties we're witnessing.
And there are so many unknowns here, Eddie. I'm curious about how this is being sold to the Rwandan public. I mean, you've been to Rwanda recently, and that is the country that you are from originally. The government seems to have an extremely welcoming attitude. Henry has now given us some insight into why that might be. But what do ordinary Rwandans think and say about this?
I would say that the ordinary Rwandans most of the time think that this is a good welcoming hand or a good gesture that is being shown by the government. But again, when you speak to some of the opposition politicians, most of whom are against the UK government sending these immigrants to Rwanda, they think that these immigrants are going to get into the coffers. I mean, most of the work that is going to be done for them is going to encroach into the government budget, which is actually not minimal and not be able to serve the rest of the Rwandans. And the other thing is that with this deal, you find that there is a special treatment that is being given to these immigrants compared to Rwandans. One of the opposition leaders told me recently that they don't think that Rwanda is ready to take care of new people before it can take care of its own people. So that's big.
And coming from a country, you know, myself, where there has been xenophobic violence, one can't help but wonder. And I want to talk a little bit more about the social and political fallout a little later on. Henry, we are in the post-Brexit era. What's public opinion on this in the UK?
It's mixed. I think the latest opinion polls suggest there is just about majority support for the government's position on treating the migrants this way, on supporting the idea of trying to clamp down on these journeys by small boat, although that appears to have waned in recent days as the policy is being challenged in the courts itself. And I think it will be interesting to see how public support shifts and moves around over the coming weeks as the legal challenges progress, and particularly they are allied as well to Boris Johnson's fortunes and the public's view of him as a leader. And he's facing several difficulties himself at the moment, not least by-elections tomorrow in two constituencies in the UK. And that could have a great bearing on his leadership of the Conservative Party and the country. I think more generally, British people do want more clampdown on immigration. They want these journeys by migrants across the English Channel to be tackled. But there is nothing clear or no agreement on how exactly that should be done. And I think it's also worth noting that while the government uses these figures of a sharp increase in arrivals on small boats across the English Channel, these very dramatic pictures of migrants on inflatable dinghies, on dangerous journeys, making that 20-mile crossing through the busiest shipping lane in the world. Before that, large numbers of migrants were arriving already just via different routes, mostly hiding in the back of lorries, for example, crossing the ferries and so on. So the actual numbers haven't actually shifted that greatly. It's just that because security at the ports in Dover and Calais has increased, so they are looking for new routes. And related to that as well is concern among many of the NGOs and refugee charities here in Britain about what the impact of the policies might be on the decisions made by the migrants themselves. So far, they are very happy to be intercepted by British security, by border patrol forces, either in the English Channel or when they arrive on the beaches of southern Britain. But if they feel that they're going to be arrested or detained and then sent to Rwanda, NGOs fear that they will be much more likely to go underground to try not to be caught, to maybe make the journeys at night, which is obviously far more dangerous, and then to arrive in Britain and try to remain underground, essentially, and that puts them at far greater risk of exploitation and trafficking. So there could be many knock-on effects of this policy as well. We wait to see what happens. It's clear that there is public support for greater management of the migrant situation, but still nothing clear on what policy that should be.
We see religious leaders have now stepped into the fray with the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Anglican Church, a very influential figure, of course, in the UK, calling this policy immoral and that it shames Britain. And that, I guess, brings up the question, Eddie, of whose morality we're talking about here. The Archbishop of the Anglican Church in Rwanda, Laurent Mbanda, he disagrees. He says that isn't. He doesn't think it's immoral, and we heard the Rwanda's government spokesperson, Yolande Makolo, respond to a question from journalists along those lines. I just want to play that clip. Let's take a look.
We don't think it's immoral to offer a home to people, something that we have done here for more than 30 years, and we're doing this for the right reasons. So people may have their own opinions about what this program is like, depending on where they're coming from, but from where we're coming from, we're doing this for the right reasons. We want Rwanda to be a welcoming place, and we'll do our best to make sure that the migrants are taken care of and that they're able to build a life here.
Well, she says she says the government believes that it's not a punishment to live in Rwanda. Eddie, she also talks about the misconceptions created in what she says in the media about Rwanda. Does she have a point here? Some of the outrage more about the policy in question or the place in question?
I think it's could be both. When you talk to some of the people who are pro to this agreement between Rwanda and UK, most of them seem to think that it has actually created unnecessary attention on Rwanda. Rwanda, a country that is welcoming. Rwanda is home to close to over 100,000 refugees from the region, Burundi, DRC, Congo. And also, you remember that Rwanda has accepted to receive most of the detainee immigrants who are being shipped from Libya and being settled in Rwanda, where they get processed and then sent to different countries, either in Europe and Canada. So many people think this is an unnecessary attention that Rwanda is getting. And at the same time, the timing also was not so good for this deal to come. Number one, we are talking of people raising issues to do with human rights when Commonwealth Summit is underway. We've been reading in the media lots of attention being given on the trial of Paul Rusesabagina, who was one of the people that Hotel Rwanda was made from. And also the recent political crisis between Rwanda and DRC. That, too, is creating so much noise outside that the government thinks is unnecessary, given the fact that they've done a lot when it comes to receiving immigrants. But again, this deal has created unnecessary attention to them.
Very briefly, Henry, I want to move on, but we don't have a lot of time. But, you know, I'm very curious about the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel. She's come under intense criticism over this policy, too. Of course, she's a staunch backer of Brexit, very tough on immigration. But critics point to her own background, that her parents were refugees themselves. They sought refuge. They were originally from Uganda. What does this mean for her political career? Is this going to make her star rise or fall?
She's had a sort of rollercoaster political background, really. She was fired from her post previously for sort of freelancing on foreign policy, brought back into government under Boris Johnson. This is one of her flagship policies, and she is the main cheerleader for it. You saw her there signing the deal in Rwanda. As you say, her parents sought refuge in the UK. They lived in Uganda under the regime of Idi Amin, but they moved to Britain in the late 1960s, Britain opened a policy of allowing Asians from Uganda into Britain in the early 1970s. So she claims that that policy would not necessarily have applied to her parents. She has been challenged on that, though, several times, that would she be a British citizen? Would she be allowed, would her parents be allowed in this country now under the new rules. And she's been really unable to answer that and sort of tacitly admitted that it would be much harder for her parents under this regime. But she claims that circumstances now are different and that this policy with Rwanda will work and is the right thing to do, had it have been when her parents came or had it been now in 2022. Well, difficult political questions and certainly lots of politics involved in this, not just around migrants, British Conservative Party and Priti Patel as well.
Well, this is all very fascinating. We're going to keep our eye on this story and invite you to back. Thank you so much, Eddie Rwema and Henry Ridgewell. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Eddie.
Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, my conversation with the head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department head about the IMF's role and relationships in Africa and why this is not your grandfather's IMF. We'll be right back.
I'm here in Area 1 IDP camp located in Abuja, Nigeria's capital.
I am here in Sabaribugu district of Bobojula, so western Burkina Faso.
Hapa tupatikana Kanyaruchinya, kilometa 10 kaskazini mwa mji wa Goma.
I am here in Lusenda camp located eastern DRC.
I am here in the Dadaab refugee camp located in northeastern Kenya.
This is Shuari 5 IDP camp located in Maiduguri in northeast Nigeria.
I'm here
to share
their stories.
I'm Ali Duwedra Ogo.
Neretoko Mohamed Danyoko.
Husseina Mohamed.
Mahmanur Mohamed Abdullahi.
Neretoko Mahmoud Bokum.
Al-Hassan Bala.
Ndithieri Vendayishimiye.
Ernest Mwero, reporting for VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. This is not your grandfather's IMF. That's what the head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department, Abebe Selassie, tells the media. The IMF has long been criticized for the conditions attached to its loans, which critics say hurt the countries the IMF claims to help, including those in Africa. Well, Selassie addressed those criticisms when I sat down with him recently at the fund's headquarters here in Washington, and we discussed the economic future of African countries and the region as a whole, as well as the relationship between the IMF and economies on the continent. Abebe Selassie, the head of the African Department for the International Monetary Fund, thank you so very much for your time and agreeing to speak to us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're hearing a lot of talk that a global recession may be upon us. If that happens, will it come to Africa? How will it come to Africa? And can you give us your assessment of sort of the economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa?
Thank you. I mean, I think that's a question of the moment, right? The global economy has been really hammered by, first, the pandemic and all that it wrought, and Africa really very significantly so. And now, you know, just as countries were beginning to recover and put a little bit the pandemic behind us, we've had this second major global and completely exogenous shock to our continent in the form of the fallout to commodity prices in particular that has happened as Russia invaded Ukraine. Both of these shocks, global in nature, really very, very large shocks in isolation, have like a multiplying effect and, of course, are going to be impacting the global economy and not just our countries. How it will affect our region, however, will be very varied. Huh? The continent itself, 54 countries, sub-Saharan Africa, 45-odd countries, with various economic structures. So countries that are commodity exporting, oil in particular, will have a bit more resilience to the shock. But countries that are oil importing, commodity importing, will be impacted severely. And then within countries also, there will be a very varied effect. In particular, the most vulnerable households are going to be impacted the most. Food prices have gone up very sharply. Fuel prices have gone up very sharply. Fertilizer, prices have gone up. All of these, we are very worried, will be impacting the most vulnerable households in the most vulnerable countries globally quite significantly. So even if countries do not slip into a technical recession, an individual country fails, you know, does not slip into a technical recession, you're still going to have quite a lot of dislocation, harming the most vulnerable households acutely.
We're also hearing talk of stagflation in economic circles, language which I think is from the 70s, which means stagnant growth, but still prices are rising with inflation. Not quite a recession, but not growth. Africa's economic prospects always seem so dependent on growth. How is that likely to hit the African continent?
So, we are seeing elements of both weaker economic activity and also, you know, markedly higher prices. As I said, food prices are have gone up quite sharply and are likely to remain elevated. The same thing with fuel prices, which of course have this effect of cascading throughout, you know, other cost structures through the economy. So we are going to be seeing that tendency. Again, growth is important, of course, because, you know, it really is a nice summary indicator of overall economic conditions in a country, prospects for creating jobs, prospects for companies, you know, like it gives you a sense of how much companies are investing, how much consumption is going up. That's why growth is important, not in and of itself, but really because what it says about standards of living and living conditions. And that is going to be dampened, as I said earlier, as a result of the headwinds facing our countries from, you know, the really more difficult global environment. And what makes it really problematic in technical terms is that, you know, the policy response, how policymakers react, is going to be very difficult. On the one hand, weaker economic activity suggests that you should be trying to boost your economy, you know, allowing your fiscal deficit to widen, maybe even some monetary support. But as you said earlier, higher inflation means that, you know, that your ability to stoke activity is going to be difficult because you risk exacerbating inflationary conditions. So again, I think the extent to which you're going to see conditions of weak growth and high inflation is going to vary across the region depending on, you know, current circumstances. But overall, I think it's fair to say that conditions are not going to be as good as they ought to be, as we need them to be, to facilitate a recovery from the travails of the last couple of years.
I want to come, I'll come back a little later on to what African central banks can do right now. But I want to address the issue of criticism of the International Monetary Fund and ask you first how you would describe the relationship or the state of the relationship right now between the IMF and African countries. There has been long-standing criticism of the IMF's lending practices around conditionalities, fiscal austerity requirements, and of helping infrastructure investment happen in Africa, but then enforcing what some see as debilitating cuts in social spending programs when it comes time for those countries to actually repay the loans. How would you describe the state of the relationship, and what's your response to that criticism?
So I think, you know, our role is not understood as well, and that's partly our fault because we don't do enough to explain what it is that we do, how we work with countries. So, you know, the IMF has a threefold role in the region. So first and foremost, we, like elsewhere around the world, we provide quite a lot of policy advice on macroeconomic policy area. So we have dialogue around the world with all members of the IMF. It's called Article 4 discussions under that article of our Articles of Agreement, which established us. And we make sure that countries are pursuing policies and have, you know, encourage countries to pursue policies that are for the benefit of all countries around the world, you know, so facilitating capital flows, investment flows, the kind of and avoid policies that are destructive to the well-being of the global economy. Aggressive trade restrictions, aggressive restrictions on capital flows and the like. So we try and facilitate and make sure that the global economy works well and by having dialogue with each individual country. And we do that, of course, with quite a large number of countries in Africa that don't borrow from us, South Africa, Nigeria, and many, many others. Second role that we have is providing quite a lot of capacity development assistance. So we do a lot of technical work with central banks, with tax authorities, with ministries of finance to promote healthy economic policies. Just to give you an example, in tax administration, what is the best way in which governments can collect taxes from large companies, from other economic activities, so that they have the resources to spend on health, education that is desperately needed in our countries. Public finance, we do a lot of work to make public finances as transparent as possible, encouraging governments to publish budgets, how to go around setting up systems that will encourage openness, transparency, minimize corruption. So we do a lot of technical work, which often does not get recognized. It's the third part of our work, which is the lending activity that we do, which tends to get a lot of public attention, media attention. And this is one where governments, in need of balance of payment support, countries that are not able to raise all of the money that they need to fund themselves from the market, as they generally would, from taxes, turn to the IMF to provide financing. The nature of this engagement tends to be episodic in countries and over time. And typically, when countries turn to the IMF for financing, they are in some difficulty. Typically, and so that gives rise to, when we arrive, economic conditions are already difficult. But really important point here is that, we provide financing when everybody else is not providing financing, and we do so with a commitment from the government that, policies and measures will be taken to help improve economic conditions and so that the country can recover. And it's our financing that gives countries the time and space to be able to pursue those policies. In the absence of the financing that we do, adjustment would have to be much, much more rapid. Okay, you need automatic adjustment, and you wouldn't also have the resources to smooth and do the adjustment over time. Some of this criticism, I think, is unfair.
Well, that's what I want to ask. Where do you think, and why do you think the criticism does exist, especially in a climate where African countries do now have other options, whether some of that has been pulled back or not from entities like China? Would you want African countries to continue financing with the IMF or turn to China?
Well, first of all, I think I don't think it's like either or. Not at all. We have shown how important a role we play in supporting Africa just over the last couple of years in the wake of the pandemic. I think just to take sub-Saharan Africa, which is the part which whose work I oversee, since the onset of the pandemic, we have provided about $50 billion in financing. This is at a time when, domestic market conditions were difficult, when countries were not able to tap global capital markets as much as in the years before, including, of course, recourse to lenders like China. We were the ones that stepped in and provided this amount of financing. I mean, this is historically the largest amount of financing I think the region will have received in such concentrated period from any kind of international institution. So that shows you kind of the scale of support that we provide when countries need us. What does this money do? It gives governments the ability to be able to have much more supportive policies than they otherwise would. Okay. But I think, this financing role is supplemented, as I said earlier, by a lot of the policy work that we do. And increasingly, the work that we do emphasizes inclusion. Perhaps we have not done that as much as in the past. So a lot of the emphasis of our support in recent years has been to make sure that governments introduce social protection for the most vulnerable households, for example. Governance and transparency are a key element of the work that we do, as well, of course, as the core work, which is, making sure that governments continue to create an environment where macroeconomic imbalances continue to be recalibrated in the right direction, growth continues to be fostered. So that's how we support the region in times of need, and particularly given also how much development remains in our continent, being very mindful of that and making sure that we are supportive.
I'm glad you brought up the pandemic because, of course, it saw countries around the world spend significant amounts of money in 2020, especially to combat the effects of the pandemic. And that meant that the debt levels increased worldwide. African banks, of course, owe money not only to rich countries. They of course, owe to China, to bondholders. We saw Zambia, for instance, default in 2020. In your view, are African countries right now carrying too much debt given the situation we've come out of or are sort of coming out of and given the situation we are currently in globally?
So, you know, it really is important that when you're talking about debt or even economic policies, you talk about, you know, at the country-specific level. It's really difficult to generalize in a continent as diverse as ours. So, you know, the debt situation in aggregate, yes, has gone up. And it reflects a couple of things. I think even before the pandemic, what we had seen was countries that have been pursuing quite a lot of, you know, investment projects, infrastructure investment, health, education, quite a lot, you know, borrowing to invest in these areas, but not doing as well in terms of collecting tax revenues. Tax revenues are important because, you know, that's the way you capture the rate of return on all the investment. So you build a road, you build an electric power station. It's important that you find ways in which you are able to repay the loans that you've taken towards that. And our countries, we've not done enough of a good job, you know, in terms of mobilizing tax revenues. So reflecting that, debt levels had gone up in many countries. And then you have, of course, have the effects of the pandemic, which was really, really economically really very, significant in our countries. And what that did, of course, was it dampened economic activity, it hit tax revenues, and required governments to spend more. So debt levels went up another notch in the vast majority of countries. As a result of this, some countries have gone into a default situation or, you know, the risk of debt vulnerability has gone up in a lot of countries. And as you said, countries like Zambia, Chad is another one, have, you know, had to turn to their creditors and seek debt restructuring. And because African countries, because, you know, we have limited alternative access to capital markets, domestic markets are weaker, you know, the type of resilience mechanisms that many other countries have in an advanced world, in large emerging markets, the debt situation is more acute in our countries than it is elsewhere. But again, even within this context, it really is important that, you know, the situation of debt, whether debt is sustainable or not, is a fairly dynamic one, a country-specific one, and one that depends on the economic outlook. Just to give you a small example, you know, a couple of years ago, Angola was under quite a bit of pressure. We had an economic program supporting them. And one of the important reasons Angola was under debt pressure was, of course, oil prices being as low as they were. The government, you know, pursued quite a lot of, reforms, making sure that they could strengthen their economy. Now with the recovery in oil prices, the debt situation in Angola has changed quite a bit. So, two, 3 years ago, I would have said Angola is one of the countries that I'm most worried about. Now the outlook has changed. So that's in general, that's why I think it's really important. While in aggregate, debt levels are high, and there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done in our countries to reduce macroeconomic balances, address debt vulnerabilities, and in some cases restructure debt. But it's a fluid and dynamic situation, and one, you know, that you have to look at in a country-specific basis.
Do you think that more waves of loan forgiveness or, as you said, restructuring or rescheduling are going to be necessary from international financial institutions for Africa going forward?
So much is going to depend on what the economic outlook going forward is likely to be. It remains the case that, you know, a lot of the financing that's provided by, you know, multilateral development banks, remains some of the most concessional financing that you can find anywhere. It's much more long-term also. And these, entities continue to lend to countries, so they're providing new financing. The financing gaps that countries face, the challenge that they face, really arise more from debt that is much more expensive, commercial type debt, borrowed either, you know, in capital markets via Eurobonds or syndicated loans, etc. Those tend to carry higher interest rates, and some other bilateral debt that they have, which also have higher interest rates. But for each country, the kind of reprofiling that's going to be needed will depend on what the source of pressure that countries face are, and that's how you want to address these kind of any needs that arise for debt to be rescheduled.
And of course, giving advice is part of what you do. What, in your view, are two or three of the most important things that you would say African central banks need to do right now?
So central banks are in a difficult position, as we were discussing earlier. They're facing basically, in many cases, economic conditions that remain weak, either because recovery post-pandemic has not been as strong as you want to see, or because you're facing global, the shock from all of the turmoil we're seeing in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So they have to balance that with rising inflation in many cases. So striking a balance between, making sure that you don't reduce recovery and avoid stoking inflation is a very difficult place to be for central bankers. In the conversations and the discussions that we have, and generally it's just an exchange because a lot of the calibration is country specific, what we try and emphasize really is just what the optimal way of striking this balance is. In some countries, where, for example, the countries where exchange rates are fixed, you don't have the exchange rate also as a way to help allow adjustment. So in that case, you probably have to lean a little bit more towards monetary policy tightening and allowing interest rates to go up a bit. In other cases, it may be that you allow the exchange rate to go through. In yet other cases, you're not seeing, inflation looks to be more transitory. So in those cases, you want to be very watchful and not necessarily take action immediately. So really depends on very country-specific circumstances. But in each case, I think the overarching emphasis is about striking a balance to make sure that you don't hold back growth or kindle too much inflationary pressure.
Are there any conditions that you would say African leaders or African policymakers or countries should be prepared to accept in coming years, if international institutions do reschedule, restructure their loans, such as political or economic reforms, any kind of progressive social inclusion or other human rights improvements that could be viewed as ultimately having good outcomes for African countries?
I don't think the reason for countries to pursue their economic policies ought to be for outside audience, right? It's really much more important for our people. So I think, what I see, again, as I mentioned earlier, one area of weakness that I see in overall, in a larger number of countries is this inability to collect more domestic tax revenues. I think that remains really a very important challenge. Our countries are increasingly much more boisterous democracies. And I don't think we've started having the conversation about, how it is that, governments can collect taxes more and avoid relying on borrowing to do all of the investment, all of the development needs that our countries have in health, in education, in infrastructure. I think that piece of the social contract, I don't think has perhaps been paid enough attention in our countries. So we tend to rely on a lot more commodity revenues, but that tends to be fickle. The formal sector tends to be a bit smaller than in other countries. So what kind of policies do we need to pursue to make sure that, the larger informal sector becomes much more into the mainstream, contributes more to taxes? But these are, very deeply domestic and deeply political discussions. It will depend on in each country in terms of what kind of social contract is needed. So I think strengthening that side of our country's development is going to be, I think, very important in the future to address the development challenges that we face.
Do you foresee that becoming a condition?
In discussions with us?
Yes.
No. I mean, you know, the policy choices that countries make in order to address, you know, macroeconomic imbalances that they face, we think, you know, are going to be, you know, of course, in the realm of, you know, parliament, domestic political discussions. Our discussions tend to focus a lot more on, you know, what kind of macroeconomic policies make sense in aggregate. And then how, you know, what kind of tax structure you want to have, what kind of compositions, spending composition structure you want to have, of course, are going to be, as I said earlier, deeply domestic and deeply political discussions. Now, we will, of course, you know, emphasize the need for social protection, you know, particularly in times of economic difficulties that countries are in. You know, we would like to see a lot more emphasis on social protection. But frankly, I mean, you know, governments these days, of course, also do that. So we it's not that they need us to come and tell them that. So it's generally not a discussion that's a difficult one. But, you know, as to exactly how you countries ought to be paying for this, whether it's a tax in one area versus another, spending prioritization in one area versus another, I think these are really important conversations that have to be internal rather than being made at our behest.
You mentioned earlier inclusion and an area where you think the International Monetary Fund could have done a better job in the past. I think every government is thinking the same thing where that is concerned. What is the IMF prepared to do to help buffer or mitigate the impact of the global economic crisis on the most vulnerable communities in African countries? Women, smallholder farmers, subsistence farmers, informal traders, but particularly women?
Very good question. You know, first, I think in aggregate, as I said earlier, we have done really, I mean, you know, we, as our managing director, Kristalina Georgieva says, you know, we had a once in a 100-year shock, an unprecedented shock. And our response really has been unprecedented also as an institution this last couple of years in the wake of the pandemic. I mentioned earlier how much support we provided financially, but also in terms of policy advice, in terms of capacity development, we really, really have, you know, just stepped up like never before, I think, in our history. Second, within that, and over the last several years, you know, really very important reforms that we've been doing internally have been to emphasize both longer-term structural challenges, but also existing ones that we perhaps have not paid enough attention to. An example of the longer-term structural challenge, particularly in a forward-looking way, is climate change. So we've doing quite a lot of work right now to help countries, you know, calibrate policies and, you know, to address the climate change. In some countries, it's in the mitigation area. In other countries, adaptation. So we're doing a lot of work in that, and we've just been provided more resources by our board after quite a bit of a push to be able to expand our work in that area. Gender type issues is also a very, very important area that we're doing work on. You know, this emphasis in inclusion comes from, I think, increased recognition by our institution that, you know, in the past we expected, you know, whether it's, you know, this inequality in the gender dimension or particularly in the income dimension, we expected, you know, macroeconomic policies at the aggregate level would eventually trickle down and help foster inclusion. But that has not been the case in the income sense, but, and also gender, of course, remains, you know, the gender dimension of inclusion remains problematic in many, many countries. So we have a lot more emphasis. So we're doing quite, you know, a lot of work advising countries individually on, you know, what kind of policies are needed to facilitate gender inclusion. In some cases, it is removing policy-induced barriers, you know, actual laws that have restrictions in women participating fully. In other cases, you don't have formal laws that restrict that, but you have ways in which, you know, either directly or more subtly, the way the budget is formulated, for example, has a bearing on like adverse gender outcomes. So being mindful of that, wherever that's, you know, exacerbating, where policies tend to exacerbate gender inequality. So I would say kind of, you know, we're doing a lot more to be sensitive to these kind of issues and include them in the mainstream work that we do than ever before.
My conversation with Abebe Selassie, the head of the International Monetary Fund's African Department. He spoke to me at the IMF's headquarters here in Washington. And that is our show this week. Thank you to my guests for their time and perspectives. Thanks to our affiliates airing the show across the African continent. And as always, I'm grateful to you, our audience on television, radio and online, for always watching and always listening. I'm Hayley Adams, and I'll see you next time. Go well. Goodbye.